This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today, and it has gotten a little chilly. We had a day this week where the temperatures were in the 70s. That day was yesterday. Was it yesterday or Tuesday? Yesterday. I think it was yesterday. It was nice. It was very nice. And then we woke up today. Yesterday, I think it was yesterday, I went for a walk in the morning before I went to work, and it was 50 some odd degrees, and beautiful. And this morning it was back down a little lower, and then we had some rain move in. We actually had a little snow at one point, so, you know, we had to have been down in the 30s, I think. So yeah, going from, you know, 70, 30, one day. Welcome to the Ozarks. So that's pretty exciting. Let's see, what else happened this week? I had a very nice breakfast with a new acquaintance. An associate in town had gotten in touch with me, wanted to talk about a few technical things, and, hit it off very well, and we just had a really nice breakfast together, and we're going to do it again. So that's cool. So that was fun. The improv comedy, this class is slowly coming to a close. We now have two more classes, and at the end of our last class is when we do our showcase. So the reality of it is setting in now. And after Monday night, I just felt like I did lousy Monday night. I didn't feel like I was supporting my fellow players very well, and, you know, just not good. But I have since thought about it a little bit more and tried to figure out what I can do better. And so we'll see. My daughter's coming over this evening. They're going to look at a house for a little bit, and then afterwards they're going to be in our area, so they're going to come over, and then we're going to run a few scenes and just see how it goes. I kind of know where it goes. One of my biggest hurdles mentally with this old improvisational comedy stuff is because I write, I'm used to the luxury of being able to go back and edit and rethink and restructure. When I was finishing up Amanda in the Skleberry Tree, I got to the end of it and I was reading and I thought, no, we need a final battle. So you just go and hinge it open, make a final battle, done. And it's funny because I do these improv scenes and then, like, I'm driving home afterwards, like, oh, I could have gone there. Oh, I could have gone there. You know, but it's too late. So now I have to be a little quicker on my feet. So we'll see. We'll see how this works out. I also have to make the decision this week as to whether or not I'm going to go on. And I think I'm going to go on. I was talking to a friend about that. And no, wait, I was talking to my son-in-law. Who else is a friend? He might, you know, thank the good Lord, my son-in-law is a good friend. I was talking to him about it because there's a possibility that my daughter will go on and there's a possibility that she won't go on. And so we were chatting about it a little bit. And I told him, you know, for me, here's the reasons that I would go on. One is I realize this does take some time to learn this skill. I feel like it is a skill I should be able to be good at, not because I'm witty and quick so much as this is a team sport and you rely on each other and you try to create an environment of success for each other, and I should be good at that. So that's the first reason I'd like to go on. The second reason I'd like to go on, obviously, is if my daughter is going to go on, it gives us a chance to do something together. And so that would be, ta-da, yes, of course. And then the third reason is that I have begun to form a rudimentary, at least, relationship with several of the other people in the class. And if they're going to go on, then it might be a good idea to go on and share that relationship and deepen that relationship with them. So we'll see. I haven't decided yet, but probably. It's going to still be on Monday nights, just a little bit later, so that'll be cool. Because, you know, I can go over to Liz and Alan's and gobble some food down, and then we can practice improv a little bit, and then we can go. So it'll be fine. In terms of the writing, I am up to the trial chapter in Grumpy Old Prophet's Part 4, which is Book 3. And I wasn't sure how I was going to bridge through that, but I think I have that now. And I just need to put a little filler in there so that I've got something between the major scripture passages that I'm going to do on the trial and the crucifixion. The book is running long. I was expecting the book to be about 80 pages, and it looks like it's going to come in around 120 or so. I mean, the life of Jesus was long as well. It was 160 pages, but technically it was two parts, wanting and waiting, and so, but that'll be fine. There's some I can kind of cut back, but everything that's there so far is good. So I think that'll be fine. So I have this chapter on the trial and early crucifixion section to do. And then I have the chapter on the darkness. And then I have the chapter on the death and pre-resurrection. And then we'll have this wrapped up. And then I've got to start editing because I'm really going to try to have this in beta by first week of April. It was going to be around April 1st, but it's looking a little tight now. Because this is already, the first week of March is gone. That was 3 weeks. And I don't think I can get that done in 3 weeks. But anyways, it's going fine. It's going fine. It's interesting, just as a tidbit, on Tuesday, I really kind of had to step myself back a moment and settle things down because I did not do well Monday night on improv. I just didn't do very well and I was kind of unhappy about that. And that was kind of getting roiled up in terms of unsettledness. And of course, I'm working at the same time on trying to get Grumpy Old Prophet's Part 4 finished up. At the same time, I'm trying to deploy a fairly large project at my major client. So all these deadlines are coming up. And, you know, I could feel the unsettledness. And finally, at one point, I just kind of rocked back. And I said, wow, Jesus, you know, the flesh is really trying to dig in and get me unhappy about some of these things. And there's really no need for me to be unhappy about any of this. Everything's pattering along. You're going to help me through all this, just as you've always helped me through all this. So I just prayed for a little bit. And once you identify it, you know, once you get the light down on those cockroaches that are down in your soul trying to stir you up, you know, then it just starts dissipating. And turned out to be a good week. Didn't quite get as much done as I wanted to. There were some interruptions this week, but that's okay. We made some really good progress. And, you know, it's going to be fine. This last week, week before that, can't remember when, I read an interesting article. And it's especially interesting in the light of my life experience right now, because my dad is 89, my mom is 85. And it has been within the last few months that I've looked at them and thought, you know, it's not going to be too terribly long. The lovely thing about my situation is both of my parents are not afraid of death. They're ready to go. My mom keeps saying that my dad has to go after her. She says, no, no, he's not allowed to leave first. Because I don't want to be here without him. And that will remain to be seen what happens. My parents just recently had a checkup with a doctor, and a nurse practitioner, and they ran some blood samples, those types of things, and you know, it looks like there are some things that need further investigation. At the same time, my mom has been struggling a little bit with her memory, and so we're in that time of life. And I came across this article, and the title of the article was Why Doctors Die Differently. And I started reading this article, and it just kind of confirmed a few things that I have thought about how I want to die when I die. And it sort of solidified, I think, what is going to be my approach. Now, I do need to get an advance directive done to make sure my wishes are followed. But this is an interesting article. Ken Murray is the author of it, and he started out talking about a doctor named Charlie, who was a respected orthopedist, a mentor of the author of the article. He found a lump in his stomach, and it was diagnosed as pancreatic cancer. Diagnosed by one of the best surgeons in the country, it's pancreatic cancer. Okay. Well, as you probably know, that's a pretty aggressive cancer, one of the most aggressive, and the survival rate is very small. This particular surgeon who had diagnosed him, he had developed a procedure that would triple the chances of survival. It would take it from 5% to 15%, albeit with a poor quality of life. Okay, so what did Charlie do? He's a doctor. According to the article, he was uninterested. He went home the next day, closed his practice, never set foot in a hospital again. He focused on spending time with his family. Several months later, he died at home. He didn't want any chemotherapy. He didn't want any radiation. He didn't want any surgery. And in the article, the author says, this isn't really something that we talk about too much, but that's pretty normal for doctors. He said, what's unusual about doctors is not the extraordinary care that they get compared to most Americans, but how little care they get or they ask for than most Americans. You know, they've seen it. They know what's going to happen. They know what their options are. But they tend to just say, okay, and just go serenely and gently. That's very interesting to me. He was talking about the fact that doctors usually take care to make sure that their family knows their wishes, that they get advanced directives in, and those advanced directives are don't take any heroic measures, including CPR, because they don't necessarily want someone breaking their ribs by performing cardiopulmonary resuscitation, which the author says is what happens when CPR is done right. They break your ribs. One of the interesting things in the article was that a woman named Susan Diem did a study with others and looked at how CPR is portrayed on television. And she found that it was successful in 75% of the cases on television. And that in 67% of the cases, the TV patients went home. When compared with the actual numbers in the hospital, in fact, only 8% eight percent of patients on whom CPR is performed actually survive, and only about 3% could lead a normal life afterwards. So what you're seeing on television was stat, code blue, get in here, epinephrine, boom, hit him, boom, you know, all that stuff. Okay, hospitals do that, but for the most part, people do not come back, and if they come back, they don't do very well afterwards. Something to think about. It's interesting because in the article, the author references, I'm getting my mail, one moment. The author references a nursing professional named Karen Kell in an article called Moving Towards Peace, an analysis of the concept of a good death. And in this article, she ranked the attributes of a graceful death, and among them were, oh, I forgot to put the lid on the mailbox back up. And among them were being comfortable and in control, having a sense of closure, making the most of relationships, and having families involved in care. And the fact of the matter is that hospitals don't provide many of those qualities. They don't make you feel like you're in control of what's happening. You know, they don't really make the most of relationships or allow family members to be a part of the care. Oh. I have been allowing someone else to park in my garage, and while I was running off at my mouth here, my ingrained habits kicked in, and so I backed up to go ahead and back into the garage, but I don't have my garage door opener because we have a friend staying with us who is using the garage. So I won't be pulling into my garage. I'll just pull up beside the house here. Anyways, so hospitals don't provide many of the features that, according to this nursing professional, said were the features of a graceful death. He goes on to talk about the fact that written directives are really good. Advanced directive, advanced care directives, whatever you want to call them, they are really good because it gives people a chance to tell their loved ones what they want done and what they don't want done. Now, what's interesting is that he said there was a survey done of 765 doctors. And the survey found that 64% of them had created an advanced directive, whereas it's only about 20% for the general public. So the doctors are looking at this, and they're going, yeah, okay, we got to make sure that these heroic measures and all that kind of stuff are not going to happen, because doctors, for the most part, are apparently looking for a more graceful death than all the medicine provides. And the author of the article is careful to say, you know, it's not that we don't trust our own medical care, but we've seen it all. He said, in the past, in previous eras, doctors would do what they thought was best. And now our system is based on what patients choose. And he said, physicians really do try to honor what patients want. But when the patients ask, well, what would you do? He said, we often avoid answering because we don't want to impose our views on the vulnerable. And so if there's a potential, any kind of potential, and people say, yeah, I want that. Okay, fine. You know, they'll go ahead and do it. But that doesn't necessarily lead to a graceful death. That doesn't necessarily lead to a wholesome experience in life. And I've said for some time, if I come down with cancer, I really do not want people poisoning me with chemo and burning me with radiation and cutting me open with surgery. I'll just, you know, I just go home. And the doctor actually ends the article with his cousin. He says, several years ago, his older cousin, Torch, born at home by the light of a flashlight, had a seizure. Turned out to be the result of lung cancer that had gone to his brain. Okay, so we learned that with aggressive treatment, including 3 to 5 hospital visits a week for chemo, he perhaps would live another 4 months. And he said his cousin was no doctor, but he knew he wanted a life of quality, not quantity. And he said ultimately he decided against any treatment and simply took pills for brain swelling. And he moved in with the author of the article. And the author of the article said, for the next 8 months, he said, we had fun together like we hadn't had for decades. We went to Disneyland because he had never been to Disneyland, hung out at home. He said Torch was a sports nut. He was very happy just to watch sports, eat my cooking. He had no serious pain. He said one day he didn't wake up and he spent the next 3 days in a coma-like sleep and then he died. As a side note, the cost of his medical care for those 8 months for the one drug he was taking was about $20. Now, obviously, it's not all about money. But by the same token, if I can save my relatives a lot of money, and I can have good quality of life and spend time with them as I'm waiting for the end to come, I really think I would rather spend time with them. Even if the quality of my life isn't perfect, I think I would rather spend time in relationship than being cooped up in hospital rooms or outpatients' rooms getting filled with chemicals or burned with radiation or cut on. I think I would just as soon go home. But of course, that's a decision that every person needs to make for themselves. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.